Is anyone engaged with any quadrant? Like, for example, the compulsion state can be defined, but he's defined it as underground. He's gonna entertain passive-aggressive behavior, and that's what anorexia often is passive-aggressive behavior. But it's not going to be outright defiant. So we take the word defiance and say that defiance is more characteristic of this quadrant, although every kid is going to be defiant in some way, you see. Every kid is going to maintain his distance, but this kid is out more outrightly distant, just doesn't want anything to do with authority. So don't carry these descriptions too far. You will see defiance and distance in every one of them, as well as compulsiveness, compulsivity. Now, this is the controlling manipulative pattern. And this fourth one we don't deal with much as adolescent counselors. We don't see many of these kids. This is called the confident compassionate quadrant. And that's why if you're working with kids, you really ought to not just be working with them exclusively in counseling, because you tend to get kind of a tenant view of kids. You tend to see them from these three quadrants and forget there really are these kind of kids around. There really are a lot of healthy adolescents out there. But it's easy to forget that when all you see is one troubled adolescent after another. By the way, Larry once told me when I was rather discouraged about a counseling situation, he says, Kevin, says if you can help 2 people out of 10 as a counselor, you're really batting high. You're doing great. 2 out of 10. And I'd like to revise that a little bit for counseling adolescents and tell you that if you're helping 2 out of 20, you're doing great. Mm-hmm. And that's why I always ask somebody that tells me they want to specialize in counseling adolescents, I say, why? Why? Why in the world? It's discouraging work, and you often get it when it's very late and the prognosis is poor. And you're dealing with 3 adults now, not 2, and 2 of the adults have the goal of controlling the 3rd one. You never have that in any other kind of counseling situation. You're often having to deal with a whole network of agencies. Very rarely by the time you get the kid can you work independently with the kid in your office. You have to work with the parents. Very often you have to work with school facilities because this kid is about to get kicked out of a school and you have to be working with the principal or guidance counselor. Oftentimes you must be working with the welfare agency because this kid has been involved criminally or he's been abused at home. Or very often you have to be working with a psychiatrist who can hospitalize the kid for you because he's suicidal, or he has to be put in the hospital occasionally to pump nutrition into his bloodstream because of anorexia. Or oftentimes you have to be working with the court system and a probation officer who is very concerned about this kid and be calling in regular reports and working with him when you see something coming down the road as far as some behavior. Or you might have to be working with foster parents or an institutional kind of home setting that he's in. And so there's just a whole network that very often your counseling adolescent situation takes, and very seldom does it take your standard kind of counseling picture where you're sitting in the office just kind of meaningfully chatting with a teenager. You know, very seldom does it really take that on, because by the time it comes to you, no kid wants to sit with you in your office. You know, his strategy is working fine. That's why his parents are in to see you. He's got control of his home, and he's not interested in messing that up. He doesn't want to talk to you. So, you know, I don't want to paint this as glamorous or easy or a piece of cake. And when I draw a chart like this, I don't mean to say, hey, man, we've got this thing down in a few pegs and, you know, expect a lot of success. This is hard work, and it's discouraging work, because you're dealing with so many individuals in the family. A couple kids, mom and dad, and usually one of the parents don't want to work with you. So you got a situation there, you got a broken home situation, or one of the parents has been involved in abusing the kids. So you've got a whole lot of dynamics here, and it just makes the whole thing real messy. But we can say that kids will fall into one of these volitional patterns according to their core assumptions. Now, take a minute to turn over to your page, your notes. And I wanted to spend a little time on this chart right now and talk about these 3 kinds of kids. Your compliant compulsive kids, your defiant distant kids, you're controlling manipulative kids. I'm afraid to do that. You can feel free, though, to take a break, to kind of scoot out and that kind of thing. Let's all stand up for a second. Just stand up and stretch. If anybody needs to... I don't normally. Okay, the common phenomenology is what I was just talking about as far as the behavior at each of these stages. You're going to have, again, you're going to tend to have under the first one, the compliant compulsive kid, your obsessive compulsive behaviors, your eating disorders. You're going to have here your acute depression, where you have just your very severe lapse, and it comes more at the end of a big failure, big disappointment for a kid. And by the way, you're going to have your chronic depression, which is going to be characteristic of controlling manipulative kid, and it's very important to me to know more about the kid when I find out he's threatening suicide. Because if it's a compliant kid that is threatening suicide, he'll do it right. Because he does everything right. And he doesn't want to hang around and face any embarrassment or shame afterwards. So if it's a compliant, compulsive kid that's threatening suicide, I'm going to be far more concerned about it than if it's a manipulative controlling kid, because the function for a manipulative controlling kid is to be around after the suicide attempt to collect all the things it accomplishes for him, all the pity and sympathy, and all of the help. So most likely, he's going to, I still have to take it serious, because he could be accidentally successful. And I'd be concerned about that, but the compliant kid is not going to be ineffective very often attending suicide. He's going to be the one who's going to take the car, driving in a tree 90 miles an hour. He's going to figure out a way where there's no possibility of blowing it. Because his whole life has been, if you do it right. And he doesn't want to face the shame of an attempted suicide later. Now, your defiant, distant kids, that's where you're going to have more your criminal activity, your running away kinds of things, your involvement in drugs. Although, again, remember that kids who are highly disillusioned, compliant kids, as they begin testing, where are they going to go? They're going to go in the defiant category. And they're going to maybe start experimenting with drugs. Your defiant kid, who gets in a lot of trouble and finds out that, man, I don't want to go to jail, he's going to start testing with a different assumption. Where's he going to go? The compliant one. The controlling manipulative kid isn't going to have to do too much testing, because mom and dad always bail him out, and it works pretty good. You see? So also often you got your compliant kids testing around with defiance, your defiant kids testing around with compliance, and your manipulative kids, it's working. And those are sometimes the hardest kind of kids to work with, because they really have control of the home in a very effective way. Now, the basic core assumption of each one of these, let me give that to you. Now, again, as you're working with a kid, you need to I'm just going to give you the broad parameters of what it will be like, what it will taste like. But you need to figure out exactly how you would say it the most meaningfully for this kid. But the basic category, though, of each of these is what I'm about to give you. Now, with the basic core assumption with the compliant compulsive kid, he's going to believe that his personal circle will be filled if he can meet the expectations of others. If he can just meet the expectations of others, he will finally get what he really longs for. And so this kid is committed to three activities at school. He's doing, lots of things at home. He's breaking his back to please his parents, and he still feels empty. So what's he going to do? He's going to volunteer for two more extracurricular activities at school and get under more expectations. Until finally the expectations just are crushing him, and it's not getting him anywhere. And in that instance, one of two or three things might happen. We might have our suicide, acute depression suicide, or we might have at that point this kid deciding, I'm going to be defiant, I don't care, and running, switching over to another track, trying another course, something, you see. But this kid generally will add expectations before he tries anything else. He's compulsively seeking more authority to get under, more expectations, because he really believes that by meeting expectations of others, I will be able to finally get my personal circle filled. Now, the defiant, distant kid, his is just about the opposite. His belief is, I get my personal circle filled if I can escape the expectations of others. If I can just get away where no one's going to put any strings on me and escape it, just get away, my personal circle will be filled, because basically, if I just had the freedom to do what I want to do when I do it, I'd be great. Life would work for me if I could just do what I want to do when I want to do it, and the only thing that's keeping me is what people have put on me and expect from me. So if I can just get away from authority, escape expectation. So this kid, you know, he hears an announcement or he gets an invitation to come to a church social event. Now, what is his basic core assumption? Life will work for me if I can escape expectation. What does church represent to him? Expectation. Where's the last place he's going to be Friday night? See, these kids, you're never going to reach through church programming. Never. It's going to be reached more on a one-on-one basis of building a relationship, and a relationship that's more a peer relationship than an authority-based relationship as far as reaching him through evangelism. That's not necessarily the strategy for counseling. Now, the last kind of kid here is the controlling, manipulative kid, and his personal circle strategy is this. I can get my personal circle filled if I can only change or control the expectations of others. It's my goal to be the exception to every rule. The teacher announces, if you don't get this paper in by Monday, you won't pass the course. And what is this child thinking? Oh, I'll get around it one way or another. Either Mom will type the paper for me, or I'll be sick Monday, or Mom will send a note with me, or I'll come up and explain to the teacher why I am an exception. But some way I will be able to get out of expectation. The reason is I basically see myself as incompetent and unable to meet people's expectations. And I'm scared to death of being exposed as inadequate. So my way of keeping from being exposed as inadequate is to keep changing the expectations, getting exceptions made, lowering the expectations. That way I'll never be exposed. I know a guy that will do that project for me. If I just act like a dumb blonde, if I act like I can't think right and just kind of act sexy and flirty, he'll do it for me. And that's where some of these strategies or behavior patterns come from. It's a way of being manipulative and controlling. Being able to do that. What is the personal circle need of each one of these adolescents? Well, what I mean by the need is this. Is what really has to happen to set this kid free? To begin to give him freedom to pursue a more biblical pattern. And let me suggest to you that for the compliant compulsive kid, what he needs to experience is autonomy. A full personal circle while being autonomous from others. He needs to experience the fact that there really is life apart from others' expectations. I really can't have a personal circle while being autonomous. See, this kid really believes that if he ever goes against what other people expect, then he'll be destroyed. And if some way, through my counseling and my working with parents, if I can help this kid experience going against others' expectations and finding life, and finding that it really won't destroy him, and that there really is a sense of fullness, even when you go up against others' expectations, it's going to begin to set him free. As he begins to have personal circle experiences while being autonomous. This kid believes that autonomy means death. Autonomy means exposure. Autonomy means, you know, the loss of everything I want. And so I'm going to be working with the parents and working with this kid to help him experience autonomy. The hard thing is when this kid is in an environment constantly in church, in Christian school, in a variety of environments that says autonomy is bad. If you're a good Christian, you kind of walk lockstep with everybody else. To come up with ideas to do things differently, or to question, or to come out with an initiative of your own, or to say, I don't want to do it that way, I want to do it this way. When those are punished and put down, it only reinforces this kind of idea. And so you find a lot of your compliant, compulsive kids doing great in certain kinds of schools, private school situations. And that's been what my experience has been, or my observation about Christian higher schools and secondary schools, has had a hard time producing male leadership. And one reason is during this very formative period of time where males need to experiment with taking initiative and being volitional and being autonomous, there's very little room created for them to do that. Very, very little room. especially when they got a Christian home that's kind of backing up the same kind of philosophy, that what we've got to do is we've got to restrict our kids. And we've got to guard them from being volitional right now. And as a result, then, we've got a kid that moves into adulthood never having developed autonomy. And so he goes to the state university. And his basic core assumption says that you meet the expectations of those who are in power and you have a full personal circle. So he goes to state universities in the dormitory, and now, what are the expectations placed upon him by those in power? To drink, to smoke pot. And so this kid does it. And where it gets back to the Christian school, that some of our graduates are at the state university and they're sinning. So what we have to do is make it tighter. We weren't tight enough on the kids. We've got to buckle down here, man. We let a few get through. And so it makes it even worse. See, that kind of idea. And so kids have been just reinforcing this idea that you just have to identify and conform to whoever has the power, meeting their basic expectations. So they didn't experience autonomy. I really can say no to the guys in the university. I don't want to smoke pot with you guys tonight. I'm not going to do that. Now, see, he won't have the personal strength to do that unless somewhere in high school I helped him have that experience and he found out it won't destroy him. See, all his life he found out that if you disappoint somebody, you get destroyed. So now he's in the university and he faces disappointing a lot of people. One of his professors wants him to do something immoral. The guys in the hall want him to do something immoral. He's always believed if you disappoint people, you'll be destroyed, and so he's caught. So he drops out and comes home. That's something like that. But see, if in high school I've helped him to experience autonomy and find it doesn't destroy him. In fact, it gives a sense of strength. And and God can even be found as protecting you when you take initiative. And you say, well, you know, don't you have to be afraid? You know, you never know what kids are going to do if you let them do what they want. The compliant compulsive kid, you know, he's the one you have to be afraid of the least as far as what he's going to come up with and do. You know, what you have to do is kind of beat them into defiance or just kind of push them. It's so hard to get them to go against the expectations of others because they're scared to death. Now, what is the personal circle need of the defiant distant kid? Well, I was talking recently to a guy who works exclusively with defiant kids. He's in a social agency. And so I had my pet theory. I already had this chart in place. And so I thought, I'm going to test it here. I said, what have you found helps in defiant kids? What really helps turn them around? If you found anything, he says, we've only found one thing that helps, and that is to take them out one-on-one into a wilderness setting where they're with an adult and they learn to depend on an adult, that they can depend on an adult, will come through, and it really won't destroy them if they allow themselves to get close to an adult in a dependent relationship. And I already put down here, and I already had said that what a defiant kid needs is to experience full personal circle while being dependent on others. See, this kid has come from a home environment where he's never really been able to depend on anyone to come through for him very much. So he's kind of learned that adults are only out for themselves. They're selfish, authorities want to use you, and if you give in to them and depend on them, they're just going to use you. They don't care about your happiness. They don't care about how you feel. They don't care about your personal circle. And I can't depend on them. And for this child to learn that he can really depend on someone and not be destroyed, it has a revolutionizing effect on his life. He begins a whole new area of trusting God and depending on God opens up into his life. The controlling manipulative kid, he needs to experience personal circle fullness while being responsible to someone. This kid has always thought that if I'm ever caught up where I actually have to perform for someone, I'll always fall short and I'll be destroyed. So for this kid to be caught in a situation where he's actually being responsible to someone else for something and held responsible and yet not destroyed even when he falls short, he's going to learn, I guess I can fail and it's okay. But sometimes I succeed, I guess I can be confident too. And that's the direction we want to move him. Now, the foolish strategy or the volitional pattern, though, tends to go in just the opposite direction of what the kids need. The foolish strategy, we've already said, that the compliant kid wants to get under adult structure. And that just prevents him from experiencing dependence. You know, your typical compliant compulsive kid autonomy is what I'm talking about. Your typical compliant compulsive kid has no free time. Literally, he is under authority and expectation from the time he gets up to the time he goes to bed at night. And most days he experiences no autonomy at all. In fact, when he does experience autonomy, he feels scared. And he'll come to mom and dad and says, what do you think I should do here? He doesn't want to have to face the possibility of making his own decisions and getting disapproval for them. So he gets under as much adult structure as possible. He seeks counsel. He has to decide. Compliant kids, they have really a hard time making decisions about where to go to college unless their parents tell them where they want them to go. But if the parents leave them up to them, it's hellish for them. Man, they go to 14 different experts and ask them, where do you think I ought to go to college? And everyone says something different. And this kid is just in a terrific bind. He doesn't know where to go. Mom or dad are kind of silent on this. This is the first time they've been kind of silent on something. And it becomes very hellish. Because I could ruin my whole life by this decision. I could really ruin my whole life. Now, of course, the defiant distant kid, his goal is to escape adult structure. And that prevents him from ever having a dependent relationship with an adult, ever finding out that he really can be in a dependent relationship and survive. And of course, your manipulative controlling kid is trying to reshape adult structure so he never has to face responsibility. So the kid's foolish strategy, the more successful it is, the more it prevents him from ever having the experiences that are going to be healing for him, setting free. And the result is just the opposite then. Instead of autonomy, we've got unhealthy dependence on whoever has the power in his world. For the defiant kid, we got an unhealthy loneliness or independence and aloofness. And for the controlling manipulative kid, we got an unhealthy sense of being helpless. Unhealthy dependence, unhealthy loneliness, unhealthy helplessness. Now we're going to see that in a moment that the way the parents tend to respond to these kids in most cases strengthens the core assumption and keeps moving in the direction. What I have found to be the most accurate shorthand, it's not always accurate, so don't use it, but what I have found to be the most accurate shorthand is if I'm on the phone, or the other day a parent called me up and said, we have to go pick our kid up at the jail, he just got thrown in for doing such and such again, what should we say to him when we get there? And my first thing I wanted to ask him was, what do you want to say? And normally I tell him, say the opposite, mm-hmm. or do the opposite. Because what I have found is more times than not, the first instinct of parents is to react in a way that just strengthens the misbehavior or the destructive behavior. Now, not always. We do have some healthy parents around. But more times than not, the natural tendency or instinct, because parents arbitrarily respond, they don't stop and say, now, wait a minute now. There's something going on inside of my kid that's not healthy. What is it? And what I do is I try to teach parents a four-step response of how to think more deeply about their kids before they make a decision how to respond. If I have time, I'll give you those steps today before I go on. But I try to take them through those four steps. Now, let's go back to the front page, and we'll come back to the chart in a minute. Let's talk about these home environments now. By the way, I didn't say much to you, did I, about the emotional circle. Let me just say this real quickly to you about the emotional circle. You're going to find that three things are going to be true of adolescents when you're dealing with them as far as their emotions. Three things. One is that their emotions that they are experiencing are more intense and exaggerated than your typical adult. They're more intense and exaggerated. There's a book out by, it's called Being Adolescent. Being Adolescent, it's by Basic Books. The author, if you want to write his name down, is Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi. Good Polish name. The co-author is Reed Larson, if you want to write that down. But Csikszentmihalyi and Larson did a study of 75 high school kids. They put beepers on them, and for a period of months, beeped them randomly according to a computer, and the kids had kind of a little log, and any time they got beeped, they recorded what they were feeling, what they were doing, who they were with, just a variety of categories. And they put all this together in this book to try to objectively portray what it's really like to be adolescent. And one of the best data we get out of the book is really what it's like emotionally. And so I'm taking this right out of their findings. They found, and they did the same thing with a control group of adults, they have found that the mood changes, that as far as the width of the mood changes on nearly every mood item, I'll just read here. What's that? No, intense or exaggerated is the first characteristic. Intense or exaggerated. And they said the width of mood changes on nearly every mood item or every mood that was registered on almost everyone, adolescents reported a significantly wider variation than adults. Meaning that when an adult reported depression, that the depression was much more severe for an adolescent. When they reported joy, the joy was much more severe, exaggerated. Okay, so their highs are high and they're higher and their lows are lower than your average adult. That's what I mean by intense or exaggerated. The other one is, the second one, is ambivalence or unpredictability. They tried to predict how the kids would feel on the basis of their environment. They thought, well, kids are going to feel better when they're with their friends and worse over here, but they found that it was almost impossible to predict how kids would feel on the basis of who they were with, where they were doing, and what they were doing. Kids are very ambivalent and very unpredictable. And so you might plan a social as a youth worker and say, now every kid loves to do this, and all kids like to do this. And the kids come out and the thing's a complete bomb. You're trying to figure out, now wait a minute, we did that a year ago and the kids loved it. It's very unpredictable, very, very unpredictable. The third thing is, there's a rapid fluctuation in their emotions. That their moods, the moods of adults lasted much longer than the moods of kids. Like, for example, okay, we're saying that the kids' joy spots are much wider, or taller, or more intense, but they're much shorter. They last less. Where the adult might not be as happy, but his happy mood will last longer, you see, than the adolescent. So you've got kids that can be just cheering and yelling and screaming and everything at the beginning of a meeting and quickly move into a serious moment, where with adults, you know, you couldn't quite do that. The same is true with kids. You know, you've got more of this manic depressant kind of flavor. They can change their moods much more quickly. Now, how kids manage their emotions is often a function of these volitional patterns. Is often a function. For a person to have a full emotional circle, we're saying what? That they are aware of what they're feeling, right? Well, let me just to give you an idea of awareness versus expression. There's two different things in the emotional circle. One is, awareness is what you're aware you're feeling. Expression is what you choose to let other people know that you're feeling, right? Well, it's different for each one of these kids. You're going to find that with the compliant compulsive kid, that he's going to have very low awareness. Let me get a different pin out here. He's going to have a low awareness of what he's feeling. He can have intense anger and not be tuning into it at all. You're going to find he's going to have a very low awareness, and he's going to rarely express it. Because he found out that basically what he feels and what he's inside is not important at all. Not important to his world, his environment, what he feels and who he is. What's important is how close he comes to being what they want him to be. So you're going to find very low awareness and very low expression. Now we've got a very dangerous combination with the defiant distant kid. You've got low awareness of what he feels, rarely tunes into himself. He might be cussing at you and say, I think you're angry at me right now. I'm not angry. Very low awareness, but he's very expressive of what he's feeling. That's a dangerous combination. To not know what's inside and not have very much control over it either in expressing it. Okay, so that's the emotional circle. But let's talk about these home environments now again. By the way, I might just faint up here because I've just come out of being in bed for 3 weeks from hepatitis. And so that's why I spent the first half of this week kind of resting up here. It was a mild case of hepatitis, so those of you who sat next to me at dinner don't have to worry about it. It was a non-infectious type, not type A, not type B, but anytime there's a virus that attacks the liver, they call it hepatitis, and it really put me on my back for a few weeks. I'm just now starting to come back as far as strength. So just carry me out, and I'll be okay, to a cool place. I'm feeling fine right now. That's right. Okay, I want to talk about the home environment, and there's a lot I could say here. What I'm giving you right now usually takes me 6 hours, okay? And I'm going to give this to you in 6 minutes. I'm just going to give you the cream of what we do. By the way, if you want to hear more about how we minister to parents of teens, come to the Friday workshop, because I want to try to lay it out exactly how we're trying to build this ministry to parents of teens, which I believe, by the way, just a commercial here, I believe is one of the most effective open avenues we have today in churches for evangelism. Mm-hmm. Unsaved parents of teens are absolutely desperate, and they're looking for help. And we have found, since we have started providing this service to our church, we have a waiting list of more unsaved parents than saved ones that are just really, really hungry for this thing. So we're inundated right now, and we're trying to put together a whole network to be able to help parents of teens. And we see it as just a really great open door to evangelism. So that's what we're working on there. Now, the home environment, what I want to suggest to you is that each of these volitional patterns come from a certain recipe or certain home environment. They tend to come from them. And the temptation here now is to start thinking about yourself. And again, I'm generalizing for the purpose. Here's the main reason why I'm putting this chart up here. Is I want you to think in terms that every kid comes to you, you can't operate with them the same way. What will free one kid will just more bind up the next kid. And I used to do that as a youth pastor. I used to treat every kid the same and challenge them the same way and do it. And I found that only a third of the kids did it help. The other group of kids were fell in the manipulative or the defiant categories, and they needed something completely different from me. You see, so the reason why I go into categorizing is not to make it so hard and fast. Really, after you learn the categories and just learn the fact that kids are going to have different formulas or brands of getting their emotional tanks full based on home environments, throw it all away. Because I don't sit around a whole lot and say, now this kid comes from a high home environment, therefore I need to do this. I just kind of think of what that kid's needs are and go that direction. But the kid's needs will fall in a certain range. Okay, my response will always tend to fall in a certain range because I'll deal with a certain kind of kid in this direction. But not every kid, every kid that falls in here won't get the same exact treatment, because one might fall over here, one might fall over there. Do you see, they all come from different home environments. But they do have something in common. They come from this quadrant. And so they're going to have similar core assumptions. They're going to sort of go the same direction. That's the point I want to make. So you've got to be ready as a counselor with three or four different philosophies of ministry. We have a philosophy of ministry sheet written up for our youth ministry. And we have one philosophy of ministry that we have developed for compliant kids. Another one for defiant kids, another one for controlling manipulative kids. And as soon as we kind of get an idea of where a kid is at, we lock into that philosophy of ministry with him. And some kids, our philosophy of ministry is to keep them out of activities. They're compliant compulsive. And other kids need more responsibility. They're manipulative and controlling. And it's very important that when we ask a kid to lead a certain activity, we must never ask the compliant compulsive kid. Drives him crazy. But we give him attention anyway. And that's hard for him to accept, because he won't accept involvement from anybody unless he performs. But we won't let him perform, but we just love him to death. This kind of kid over here, he's not used to being responsible at all. He can just get his way. He's got a bubbly personality or a little whimsical kind of way about him. We ignore him. And until he does responsibility, then we just love him to death. Do you see? So what we're doing is trying to build a kind of environment that is fundamentally different than his home environment. So that we can challenge those basic core assumptions. So let me talk about these four home environments. This first one is what we call the high-low home environment. High in responsiveness, low in involvement. That's what the R stands for, responsiveness, and I stands for involvement. Now this produces your compliant compulsive kids. Now I have a 12-week course that I teach parenting teens to in our church. We teach it every 12 weeks. We just keep repeating it. We allow 50 parents in it at a time. And half the course is teaching parents how to build a home environment that's high in responsiveness and high in involvement. That's the goal of parenting, is to provide a high home environment for your children. And 6 of RA12 lectures are just based on teaching the parents skills of how to provide a high home environment. And then we allow small groups. We have small groups break off from that, the parents that want the support and help to implement them. Now, what we're saying is responsiveness, when it's linked to involvement, responsiveness parallels the idea of righteousness, and involvement, when it's linked to responsiveness, parallels the idea of grace. But one can't exist without being in the presence of the other. So you take responsiveness without grace, you don't really have righteousness. You have some gross, exaggerated misrepresentation of God's righteousness to the child. And if you take grace, over here you've got your low high, low in responsiveness, but high in involvement. This is your controlling, manipulative kid. And you've got parents that are very gracious on the surface, but very low in righteousness or justice, very low in responsiveness. And that's not really a good representation of what God's grace is all about. You really can't know what God's grace is until you know what his righteousness is, and you really can't appreciate his righteousness until you know what his grace is. See? The two coexist. And the same must be true in a home environment, because responsiveness now, high responsiveness, becomes something now that's evil, because it's not linked with high involvement. It's very selective, and it only responds to behavior certain in the scales. Let me give you an example of high responsiveness. Here's what we call high responsiveness. Let's say this scale is a scale of the adolescent's behavior. And this is very good behavior at this end, and this is very bad behavior at this end. The high-low home environment responds to behavior only at each end of the scale. That's the only behavior that gets a response out of the parent. The kid has to be super good or super bad to get his parents to respond to him. Now, first kid comes along, very skilled, very gifted, great achiever. The parents, based on their interactions with him, establish what the standards are to get a response at the good end of the scale. And this kid scores up here most of the time. And his strategies work, and he goes through high school as a compliant, compulsive kid and does very little testing, perfect kid. Second kid comes along, not nearly as gifted and skilled. He tries as hard as he can at school, he scores here. He tries as hard as he can in athletics, he scores here. He gets ignored by his parents because the scale was constructed with the first child. So this kid now looks at the scale and he says, how can I get a response out of my parents? How can I feel like I really make an impact on them? How can I feel like I'm important enough for them to care? And what's the answer? Go down to this end of the scale. That's where I can win. I will get more attention for my parents being bad than my brother can get being good. I'll show you. I'll win. I'll win this battle for responsiveness, for attention. And so the high-low home environment is very selective. And not only that, but it's very shallow. It only responds to the behavior, but nothing as far as core assumptions underneath it. This kid might, he gets straight A's, but this kid might get sick before every test, throw up, not be able to sleep, come home with a B+ and think about suicide. But will that make that parent stop and think, now wait a minute, maybe I don't want my kid getting straight A's. Maybe there's something going on underneath here that I have to respond to. No, not normally. As long as he's scoring up here, the high-low parent will be pretty happy, and he's very shallow in how he responds. He doesn't respond to what the inner direction is, what the heart assumption is. He normally only responds to the behavior. That's high-low. Now, the low-low, as you guessed, is low in responses, low in involvement, and the adolescent basically learns in that home environment, nothing I do really matters. If there's any response, it's inconsistent. If there's any response, it's immaterial. If there's any response, it's inappropriate. I was working with one girl who was at 19 became a Christian in our church. She'd been on the streets with a prostitute for 6 years. She told me that about the first time she ran away when she was 13, and she says, I'll never forget how my mom responded to me when I came home. I was scared to death. My aunt came and picked me up. She took me and dropped me off. She picked me up at jail. She got picked up for running away. Dropped her off at home. Her mom couldn't pick her up for some reason. She walked in the door. We didn't know what to expect. And her mom treated her like a queen. Treated her like a queen. And that's a very inappropriate response. And it was her way of saying, listen, I can't handle the trauma of you running away, so I'll treat you better and you don't run away again, okay? That's a low response from a parent. And so this girl found out that whenever she really wanted to be treated like a queen again, all she had to do was run away and her mom treated her this way. Very inappropriate. Or another low, low response from a parent would be to come home and have the parent just scream and yell and threaten and do all kinds of things, and nothing material ever happens. There's no real material punishment. And that's so common in homes anymore, is for parents to come and say, we've tried everything. And what they mean is everything except discipline. We can't get our kid to even clean up his room. Well, do you ask him to? Yeah, what does he do? And he just says, I'll wait for the next TV show or next commercial. And what happens next commercial? Doesn't go up. What do you do? I go in there and say, now you said you were going to go up there. Now the next commercial, I really want you to go up there the next time. And so it just goes on like I just nagged. Never any material consequence. Son, by the way, I want you to know that we locked your door and torched it. You have to be sleeping in the backyard. We set up a tent, that kind of thing. Whatever it might be, that kind of response. By the way, I'm going to talk tomorrow or Friday a little bit about the tough love movement. If you know the tough love parents group that's around, there's some things I really like about it, and it really is good for low-low parents. It's horrible for high-low parents. Horrible to send a high-low parent to a tough love group, but it's pretty good for a low-low parent. See, and there again, if you've got some idea of what the parent's been like, then you have some idea of what will help them. I would never send a high-low parent to a tough love group. Boy, I'll tell you. You know, because they're going to come back higher and lower. But a low-low will come back and really benefit from being with tough love group. Now, your low-high, again, this is a situation where very little is expected, very little is responded to that the adolescent does, but the parent is really involved and does everything for them and is really controlled by them. They kind of learn, hey, I can't handle life on my own, but my parents will handle it for me, that kind of idea. Now, we try to develop this in detail for the parents so they can really flesh it out, what are the different patterns, and how do I, wherever I'm at, move toward this. And I tell them that no one is a perfect high-high. Every one of us falls over here somewhere a lot of the time and that stuff. But the goal is to move toward providing the same kind of relationship for our children that the Lord Jesus Christ provides in our relationship with Him. He provides for each one of us a high-high relationship, right? And that's the kind of relationship I want to try to provide at home for my kids. And the thing is, when working with your older adolescents that you're counseling with, the good news is that even though you may never be able to rearrange the home environment and provide for them a high-high relationship, you can begin to help them picture and conceptualize and put their faith and trust in a high-high environment that they never experienced before. See? And that's necessary for healing to happen, is for the adolescent to begin to picture a high-high relationship through Jesus Christ with the Father. Now that's the home environment that I want to look at. So I want to be restructuring that, and especially with the younger adolescent, I'm going to be more concerned about it. Now I just say, if I get a 17, 18, 19 year old in, my tendency is going to be to I'm going to tend to maybe meet with the kid first, and maybe later on bring the parent in. Especially I do this with eating disorders. The reason is that I don't want to send that child signals that for his problem to get better depends on the parent taking some initiative, you see. And so many, many times with an older adolescent, I'll meet with them for a while, unless there's imminently destructive behavior, then I have to involve the parent. But I'll meet with them for a while and then bring the parents in later so that I don't send signals to this kid that, hey, for you to get better and for you to really find a solution to this problem, it's going to really take some initiative from your parents. It's not just tied up in you. I don't want to send older adolescents that message. But I'll risk it with younger adolescents. I'll risk it with them because I really can't do much with them in my office. I must indirectly help them through providing this kind of home environment. And this kind of home environment challenges the wrong assumptions that come out of these three home environments. As parents are fundamentally different and move toward this, it blows their kids' minds. It literally blows their kids' minds for the parents to respond differently when they get home. It really is a lot different that way. Now let's turn over to that chart again. And let me finish this then in just suggesting to you what would be the typical parental responses that reinforce the wrong core assumptions. The wrong core assumptions. And often the behavior. By this time, I hope that if you sat down with this for a few minutes, you could figure it out on your own. You could say, oh, well, the high-low parent's going to respond this way, and that's only going to make it worse. Like, for example, let's talk about the high-low parent. Let's say we have an event. Each one of these three kids comes home having with them a note from this school saying that they're going to get a much lower grade in this one course. Now let's see how each of these parents would respond to it. The high-low parent would tend to respond to it, first of all, by lowering involvement. They would tend to withdraw affection some way. And an angry kind of way, distance himself from the adolescent, because the high-low always gives involvement contingent upon performance. And so we see that right away, the low just gets lower. And by the way, what they'll also do is strengthen expectations. Hey, we haven't been hard enough on you. You're starting to slack off in this course. You're going to get a B, where we know you're capable of getting an A. And so now we're going to strengthen expectations. Every day now you have to bring your book home from school and you have to do this. Now, don't hear me say that it was always a wrong response from a parent. But it's a typical response from a high-low parent to lower involvement, angry kind of way, not really show much affection to the kid until he gets his grade up. And an angry kind of way, strengthen expectations. So we just see the typical response of a high-low parent is to strengthen expectations, lower involvement. And that just strengthens the core assumptions. That just strengthens it that might be underneath the behavior. It just might be that this adolescent has a lot of anger and can't express it to mom or dad, so the only way they can express anger is in passive-aggressive ways, and that is bring a lower grade home. So now mom and dad makes expectations higher, lowers involvement, makes the adolescent even angrier. What's he going to do with that grade now? Bring a C home next time. Because it's his only way of really safely, without getting smacked across the room, safely expressing his anger. And, you know, I don't know what's going on, mom. I don't know what's going on. But he knows it drives him crazy. He knows it gets to the core of them to bring home a C when it's an A. And so the parent gets even stronger in strengthening expectations and even lower in affection, and it just makes the kid angrier. And now he whips over to the defiant end. And now we've got a full-blown rebellion on our hands. High-low parents tend to react that way. What's a better way for them to react? Well, something about falling in the category of more ignoring the behavior. Unless it's imminently destructive. I know a high-low parent who was called by the school. And the school said, your daughter today skipped final period. We saw her leaving with some other kids. She went shopping. Kid has straight A's. It was the spring. It was warm weather. And for the first time, it occurred to her that she might do something that's a little inappropriate. And the parent heard this and was just totally embarrassed that their child, who does everything right, would skip school one period. That child got home from school, was approaching their 16th birthday, and was told that because they skipped school one day, they couldn't get their driver's license for another year. Now, see, my response would be to kind of take the child aside and say, hey, what's going on? You're skipping school. That's so unlike you. What was going on? Yeah, I don't know. You know, it was warm, and Susie said, let's go. And the study hall, you know, we weren't doing anything anyway, and I had all my studies done and everything. And a lot of kids do it. I didn't really know it was that big a problem. Well, you just better be careful next time. You know, you better check first or something, because they called the day at school, and they were kind of upset about it. Oh, okay. Yeah, no big deal. In fact, I'm kind of glad to see some budding autonomy in my child. I'm kind of glad to see that they're willing to kind of assert themselves a little bit and do something a little risky. But the high-low parent is going to respond by seeing that as the beginning of the end. This is it. This is where defiance creeps in. And all they do is breed defiance in the way they respond. Okay, we can go across each one like that and talk about it. But the tendency is the same way, is the low-low parent is just going to get lower and lower. They're going to attack or ignore the child. They're going to lower expectations, say, okay, I give up on you. You do anything you want. That's going to be the tendency. Or there's going to be some kind of bargain struck. We'll let you bring your girl home and sleep in the house if you just do it quietly so none of the neighbors can see. Now, that might not be done verbally, but anyway, it's a bargain that's often struck up, that kind of thing. Each one of these responses, then, we should be coming at it thinking about how the parent can respond. Now, let me give you that basic four-fold formula. It's very basic of what I take parents through when they're trying to decide how to respond. We're trying to teach them how to respond to their children rather than just respond on instinct. This is how I try to give them some direction. I take them through these four questions, very difficult questions. It takes almost a PhD to understand these questions, but we'll try them. Question number one is, how does the behavior that we're concerned about most likely, again, we're speculating, fill your child's e-tank? And at this point, I just give them Ross Campbell's very basic model from How to Really Love Your Teen. I don't ever teach the four circles to parents. I say, how does the behavior of your child most likely fill his emotional tank? And we speculate. And we talk about what in the world a kid, 14-year-old kid, would get out of beating up his little sister and a bunch of kids in school and putting his mom, locking his mom in the closet for the day. Okay, that was the situation. We had a 14-year-old that was locking his mom in the closet during the day if she didn't give him exactly what he wanted for lunch or whatever. It was during the summer. What in the world would fill that kid's e-tank? So now we're starting to think, what's the internal dynamics? What's going on inside this kid? What would he be accomplishing? Well, everything he's tried to get some kind of legitimate sense of mastery or being in charge, he failed at. He got cut from football. He has a learning disability. Can't do well in school. He lives on a farm and has no friends close to him. He flunked his driving test when he tried, or learn his permit or whatever when he tried to get it. He just went down the line. There was nothing that seemed to be anything legitimate in this kid's life. And so what he found is, by finding someone weaker and kind of dominating them, was a way to kind of give him a sense of being feeling significant about himself. So we kind of figured that out. Next question was this: what kind of ideas or assumptions about life then are underneath the behavior? What kind of ideas or assumptions about life are underneath the behavior? Now here's, we just want to get in the ballpark here. We don't have to be real, real accurate, but we just want to get in the ballpark. And what I want to do is encourage the parent to get a sentence of what his kid's basic assumption is about life. Well, it's very obvious. This kid thinks that if he can find someone weak to dominate or some kind of way to control someone else, that life's going to work for him. That's gross. We don't want our kid growing up with that. So we just work to get a basic sentence. Life will work for me if, and I usually have them started that way. Your kid really believes right now, here's what's underneath the behavior. He really believes that life will work if, and he fills in the blank. And so now I've got the parents thinking, oh man, here's this core assumption now. It fills his emotional tank. And now I want to respond in such a way, in fact, that's the third question, what response from me will challenge or weaken that idea? Ah, now my goal isn't just to control behavior. Now my goal is to go after maturity, go after the kid's heart. Now I want to try to get down to these layers of foolishness, and I want to respond in a way that says, that's painful. You try to live life according to that formula, and you're just going to find a whole lot of pain. So that's the parent's job, is to be there to make sure the kid experiences a lot of pain anytime he goes outside God's moral order to get his needs met. That's the parent's job. So how are we going to respond in such a way that makes that idea so painful to the kid he's not going to keep operating by it? And so the high-low parent comes back to that. And as the parents go through this, they come up with a fundamentally different response as they get a little objective help. And finally, the final one is, along with this response, what can we do to cultivate more legitimate e-tank, we can say as wells or filling, whatever, routes, e-tank wells within biblical boundaries? Along with this response, what can we do to cultivate more legitimate e-tank wells within biblical boundaries? So these parents are going to, in fact, what they did with this 14-year-old, he was bigger than the dad, and the dad was scared to death to do anything because he was afraid he was going to beat him up. So what we did was we figured out how we could respond. And so we picked the boy up at school. He says, "Tomorrow, don't take the bus. I'm going to pick you up at school. I got somewhere special to bring you." So we called down in advance to the police station and talked to one of the men down there. Said, "We've got a boy here that's getting violent with his sister and his mother and people on the bus. And we'd like you to just give him a tour of the jail and show him where he would stay if he gets violent again." I said, "Oh, fine. They, you know, police love to do that kind of thing." So you get down there, and they had Sergeant so-and-so meet him at the door, and he was really mad. Nobody got mad at him. Nobody screamed. "Hey, matter of fact, we want to show you where your room would be." And this kid is, you know, down there. "Yeah, your dad tells me that you beat up other people regularly, and you're cruel to your mom and that. We just want to show you where guys like that stay, and we've got this ready waiting for you next time you do it." And so they were very pleasant, and they left and got in the car. The kid didn't know what to think. And the father turned to him and said, "Son, so that's the last place in the world I ever want to see you go. That's the last place in the world. I'm committed to doing everything I can to keep you from going to this place. But you know what? I will personally call the police next time you get violent with anyone. I mean anyone. Because I believe that ultimately, if I let you do that, you're going to end up in a place like this permanently. And I want you to know what it tastes like." He didn't get rough on anybody again. That was it. End of violent behavior. But along with that response, they started to say, what can we do to give this kid a legitimate sense of mastery, of feeling important? So they started looking at how they could help him get in more to friendships and develop some hobbies and develop some things where he could start feeling some sense of importance by being responsible. And so the two link together. But the one, I think, when Paul says don't exasperate children, what he says is don't cut them off from the way they're going to eat and kill them unless you provide another way that's better. And that's what Paul is meaning there. Don't just have the parents cut them off from getting the old ways met, but have them provide a new place that's just as good or better.